First of all, welcome everyone to week three of the Mindfulness with Jewish Flavor course. Today is the final one, so we'll try and move on because we've got a fair bit to cover. Just before we start, just a bit of housekeeping. On your seats tonight, you find two things. First of all, a little postcard on the course we're starting next week on parenting. It is geared at parents with younger children, children until about the age of 10, 11, 12. If it's not relevant to you, try and share it with someone else, spread the word, and hopefully you'll get a bit of a response. We have a response already, but we're starting next week, so maybe some more people. There's still room, of course, so people can still register. The other thing is, we're going to run mindfulness again, hopefully in the future, next term, and after that, so just to help make things, or to improve the quality of the course, there's a survey on your seats. If you can fill it out at the end, please feel free to do it completely anonymously and just put it in this box over here. If you want to make a comment and you don't mind your name being quoted, you can add your name. Otherwise, just drop it in the box. Okay, today we've called Learning to Focus. Before we do that, let's just do a bit of a review. So we're working on mindfulness, which we've called the process of attending to the present moment experience in a non-judgmental way. So last week we began by just a bit of a review, just so we sum up what we've been doing till now. Last week we began with having a look again at the definition, particularly the second half of the definition, the phrase which says in a non-judgmental way. And we talked about the concept of accepting our own thoughts. And from a Jewish perspective, we brought in the famous saying, "Ha'avar ayin, the past is no more, the future is yet to come, the present is fleeting, is a fleeting moment, and where does the worry come in?" And the concept we explained was that we do take into consideration the past and the future, in Jewish thought particularly, because we are responsible, and the reason for that is because we said we live in the moment and not for the moment, so we do have a plan, we do have an overall mission. However, we let go of that which we cannot control. That was the main concept. So we shut out the past and we shut out the future in terms of things we can't control, and we just try and consider the past and the future in that which we could affect. I shared with you the AA prayer that sums it up very, very neatly, which is, "God, grant me serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change those things that I can, and the wisdom to know the difference." Okay. Which leads into the concept of being able to be mindful of the present without worrying. In other words, if we consider the past and consider the future in terms of that which can affect, but we let go of that which we cannot control, then the worry aspect, the anxiety aspect disappears. We're able to focus and be present in the moment and in the current experience. I'll just share with you something that I saw. I didn't copy it because I just saw it late, but an article which gives a bit of a checklist to know if you're being mindful or not, and it has a checklist to tick things, and if you've ticked a few of them, you know that mindfulness is still something you need to work on. I'll just read them to you because they're cute. So the questionnaire goes like this: while driving or traveling, you don't remember the experience or which roads you took, right? If you tick that, that's not being mindful. While having a conversation, you suddenly realize that you don't know what the other person is talking about. Okay, that's a problem with mindfulness. While having a conversation, you're already thinking, this is an interesting one, but while having a conversation, you're already thinking about what you're going to say as a reply to the other person even before they've stopped talking. Right? Because it's an interesting concept there, because mindfulness has a lot to do with mindful listening, or what they call today active listening, which proper listening means that you're fully focused on the now. The now is what the other person is saying. Not that you have to agree, but you have to listen, and listening non-judgmentally with a beginner's mind, with a complete freshness and openness, means to listen to what they're saying without formulating a response, so that you can fully absorb what they're saying, and then you formulate a response, right? Another one is, while reading, you suddenly realize that you've been thinking about something else and you have no idea what you just read. Okay, so if that happens to you, that's also a problem with mindfulness. Another one is, while walking into a room, you suddenly forget what you came to get. Sounds familiar? After putting something down, you can't remember where you put it. Okay. While taking a shower, you're already planning what you have to do later, and then you forget if you've washed your hair or any other part of yourself. So these are all checklists. If you tick sort of two or three of them, then you know that mindfulness is still something that we need to work on. Okay. Now, before we move on, just another concept to review from last week. I'm going to put this off. Is that right? Another concept to review from last week is the concept of every moment is the most important. We talked about that, particularly from the Jewish idea of there's no means to an end. In other words, if we live a value-based living, then everything we do, if it's based on our values, is the most important thing. Even if it's a preparation of something else, but because we're living by our values, so it's the thing that we need to do now. And then that becomes the concept of every moment is an end in itself. I didn't share with you a story, but I'll just share with you now the story which is connected to this concept. The previous Lubavitcher Rebbe was once conducting what they call a Fabrenge, which means he had his Hasidim sitting around him, and they would sing a song, and then they would stop the song, and he would talk, then he would stop talking, they would sing a song, and he would talk again. And one time he stopped talking, and they began the nigun, the song, and the song was part of the process. But obviously the song was viewed by some as some sort of intermission, and they were very eager to hear what the Rebbe had to say. So many of the Hasidim, they started to sing the song a little bit quicker, with a quicker beat than it should normally be sung. And he got upset and he stopped them in the middle and he said, "That's not the way you sing a nigun." He said, "What you're doing is, it's very, very evident that the way you're singing the nigun is that you're rushing through the nigun in order to get to the something which is happening after the nigun. And that's not," he didn't use the word mindfulness, but in Hasidic terminology, it's not being a pnimi. A pnimi means someone who's very absorbed in the moment, in doing what they're doing. If it's an important thing to be doing, then it needs your undivided attention and there's nothing else. Yes, of course it's got a mission, and of course it's got an overall purpose, living in the moment, not for the moment, but if you're doing it now, it's important. You need to be fully absorbed in that moment and not rush because you want to get to something else. Because if it's not important, you shouldn't be doing it. If it is important, get fully absorbed and be fully present. Okay, so that's just a bit of a review. Today we're going to talk about how we learn how to focus. Okay. Now what that means is as follows. It's true, and we said this last week and the week before, that mindfulness is not an exercise. Mindfulness is a state of being, right? It's not something that we do, it's something that we are. However, having said that, we know in the mindfulness literature there are a number of exercises that people do to learn the art of focusing and to really connect with the present moment. Right? And the reason for that is because although mindfulness is not the exercise, mindfulness is what we are mindful of every single part of the day. Even sometimes we have to multitask. It's multitasking mindfully or eating mindfully or walking mindfully and so on. But we still need to learn the art of being mindful. And to do that, there is a place for mindfulness exercises. And I think this is particularly relevant in nowadays because today we live a life which is so fast moving, with such a fast pace, and we rush. I think there's probably more rushing that happens today than ever before. People are always rushing. It's an amazing thing. People are always in a hurry. They're not quite sure what they're in a hurry for, where they're going, but they're in a hurry, right? So because we are in a hurry, we always seem to be rushing from one thing to the next, and we're always waiting to get to the next thing, we actually need to take a step back, and we need to experience or practice exercises that just help us calm down, focus, and learn how to be fully absorbed in the moment. Okay. Now, this concept means that we have to engage in exercises which require a few things. All right. Mindfulness exercise means we make time every day to do two things. First of all, to learn how to remove distractions. That's a very, very big art. To be present in a moment means to let go of other distractions, how to shut out other distractions. And again, we live in a time today where there's many distractions. There's so many things happening and coming at us that the distractions are many. And then, once we've gotten rid of the distractions, to learn how to absorb and focus on the moment. Okay. In other words, there's the philosophy and the mindset of mindfulness that we have to have all the time. But then there's also the intense moments of exercise where we actually intensely concentrate on the skill of being present, shutting out distractions, and being fully absorbed, and making and giving full potential to the present moment. In the words of Kabat-Zinn, he says the best way to work with these programs and to cultivate a robust mindfulness practice is to make time each day to practice formally what he calls one of the guided meditations. Now, there are many, many mindfulness meditations. There's even an app. I've forgotten what it's called. There's an app you can get today which has all kinds of... What's it?
Breathe.
It's a breathing app, yeah. There's many, many of them. And there's many, many ways that we can... Obviously, we're going to look at today a little bit what the meditation actually means and how do we apply mindfulness exercises from a Jewish point of view in a Jewish context. Now, when we talk about mindfulness meditations, there's really two things that we need to bear in mind. When we talk about a meditation, there's the subject of the meditation. So, for example, in modern mindfulness, in contemporary mindfulness, there's eating meditations, there's breathing meditations, there's sounds, thoughts, emotions, all types of different meditations, depending on what you're focusing on. For example, in the mindfulness literature, there's a whole eating meditation where they ask you to take a raisin and to put it into your mouth and to fully focus, shutting out all distractions on the taste of the raisin. It's an interesting concept, it sounds silly, but actually the truth is that most of us when we eat, we're probably not tasting properly what we're eating. We're not eating properly, and that's why people eat more than they should, probably. Right? We just keep trying to get to the taste. Right? So there's the subject or the focus of what the actual meditation is, and then there's the setting, in other words, the environment. If you look at the current literature on mindfulness, it talks about the posture, the way you sit, what you do with your eyes, how you protect the time, you guard the time each day that you devote to the mindfulness and so on. So we're going to come back to this, but what I want to do for a few minutes is I want to just examine and explore the concept of meditation. You know, when we talk about meditation, the word meditation, I think, for many people has a certain imagery that's associated with it, right? So you talk about meditation, we have this imagery of... some Eastern religion, somewhere on a mountain, someone sitting there in cross-legged position and, I don't know, offering incense and reciting a mantra of some sort, right? Eyes closed. Now, we need to know that the concept of meditation, I want to just spend a few minutes, it's a very, very complex topic, beyond the scope of tonight's talk. However, it's worth just exploring a little bit to understand, first of all, the Jewish view of meditation and the function and the goal of meditation. Because there are many, many, many forms of meditation, first of all. And second of all, there are many goals and uses and benefits of the concept of meditation. Now, if we begin, for example, just with a dictionary definition, which I found on meditation, it tells us that meditation is a practice of concentrated focus upon either a sound, an object, a visualization, the breath, the movement, or attention itself, just paying attention on attention, in order to increase awareness of the present and the moment, reduce stress, promote relaxation, right? Has different goals, and enhance personal and spiritual growth. Right? These are some of the concepts around meditation. And if you have a look at the various different benefits of meditation that's always talked about, here's a bit of a list, right? If people that engage in meditation, one of the benefits of meditation is creating inner peace and calmness by being able to focus, it lets other stuff go, it's liberating and it creates that inner peace and inner calmness. And therefore, meditation is often referred to as a form of liberation from one's own confines, connecting to something else or connecting to something higher. It certainly creates a sense of focus, which is why it helps the concept of mindfulness. It creates a sense of well-being. Mindfulness, of course, it creates an ability to be present in the now without distractions. That's why meditation is so associated with the concept and process of mindfulness. And very, very often, meditation is a form of spiritual growth. Right? Now, I want to just emphasize something very, very important. There are forms of meditation that, from a Jewish point of view, are very forbidden, actually quite prohibited. And the reason is because many, many forms of meditation that are practiced today actually have an association with what we call in Hebrew Avodah Zarah, idol worship. And therefore, they become very, very problematic, and that could have to do with the particular mantras that they use or the positions that they use and so on. And that's why you will find often in Jewish literature a tremendous warning discouraging people from engaging in meditation. So I just want to make that very clear. I don't want anyone to get the wrong message that any form of meditation is permitted. It's not. And in fact, it's from a spiritual point of view, from a malachic point of view, it's actually quite problematic. However, that doesn't mean, at the same time, that mindfulness doesn't have a place in Judaism. And in fact, it does. Meditation. And it also doesn't mean the meditation is in fact not rooted in Jewish practice. You know, there's a little story they tell. The story of where's the treasure. I'm sure many of you are familiar with the story, but it's a story of a little Yidl in a shtetl who lived in a small little house, and he had a dream, a recurring dream. The recurring dream was that in a particular city, under a bridge, there's a treasure, a very, very big treasure, hidden deep down in the ground. And at first he dismissed the dream, but he kept on having this dream again and again, so he decided, you know what, he's going to have to travel to the city and look for the treasure. So he arrives at the bridge, and he sees it's a problem, the security there, the guards that are pacing up and down. But he knows from his dream that there must be a treasure there. So he plans, he's going to wait till no one's looking. So he thinks he has the moment, and he starts to dig under the bridge, and he gets caught. And the guard says to him, "Are you mad? What are you doing, digging under the bridge? It's public property." He says, "I'll be honest with you. What am I going to tell, a lie? I'll be perfectly honest with you. I'll tell you that I had this dream, not only once, again and again, that under this bridge, there's a treasure." So the guard starts to laugh. He says, "You're crazy, you really believe dreams? You know, I'll tell you a dream I've been having. I've been having a dream that in a certain little town, a small town, in a certain address, in a certain house, in the backyard, there's a treasure hidden deep underneath the ground." And the guy says, "You serious? What was the address of your dream?" And he's listening to him, and it's his house. So the story goes that he travels back to his shtetl, and he finds the treasure in his backyard. I tell you the story because often we perceive things to have their roots and their origin in other places, and we forget sometimes that it's in our backyard. So we talk about meditation, we go looking all kinds of places for meditation, and meditation has a very, very, depending on what it is and depending on what meditation means, all types of forms of meditation, but meditation can have a very, very beneficial thing, so we go looking elsewhere, forgetting that actually meditation has a tremendous origin and is very deeply rooted in Jewish literature and in Jewish practice. Just to give you an idea, first of all, going all the way back to our patriarchs, we are taught in the writings of Kabbalah that Abraham was meditated, Yitzchak meditated. In fact, there's a verse in the Chumash where Rivka comes back and she's about to marry Yitzchak, and it says she saw Yitzchak lasuach basadeh, and he was, some people translate, he was like meditating, he was praying, but in deep thought in the field. We find that the Kabbalists have a long tradition of meditating before prayer, meditating in the fields. All different types of form meditation were found in the writings of Kabbalah, and in the prophets used to sort of meditate. The prophets, before they would prophesy, used to go in some sort of transcendental meditation, like a trance, where they would actually completely divorce themselves from their body almost and go into some sort of very, very intense form of meditation. So there's a lot of meditation in Jewish literature, historically going all the way back thousands of years from the patriarchs. In fact, some commentaries suggest, just as an interesting fact, nothing to do really with the talk, but some commentaries suggest that if you look in the Chumash, you look in the Torah, there's a story where Abraham takes some of his children, not Yitzchak, and he sends them off to the east, and he gives them gifts. And the commentaries say that the gifts were not tangible gifts, they were gifts of meditative gifts and all sorts of different types of powers that he gave them. And many, many commentaries believe that became the origin of some of the Eastern practices which became so popular nowadays, actually trace themselves back to having been received from Abraham, in fact, which is amazing. Now, even in Jewish practice and in Jewish thoughts, there are many different types of meditation. Right? For example, there are sort of the very deep and complex meditation that were used by the Kabbalists, which we have very limited literature about, and part of the reason is because actually they were considered dangerous. These types of very, very complex meditation were considered reserved for only great people, great Kabbalists, people who were on the level, who were able to engage in them, and therefore the common person was discouraged from using those practices, and therefore we actually find very little, although we find that it existed and we find a little bit of information about it, but we find very little about it because it's sort of not for the masses. However, there's one meditation which is for the masses. And in fact, is supposed to be used by every single person. Intensely Jewish meditation. And that is the meditation connected with prayer. Now, I'm not only talking about specifically prayer, I'm talking about the meditation that's connected with prayer. Right? And it's what we call hitbonanut. Okay. Now, I'm sharing with this to you because I'm going to get to an exercise which I want to share with you, but it's important to understand this before we do it. Prayer is an interesting concept. First of all, you remember the first week we talked about a Jewish word that is associated with mindfulness called kavanah. Kavanah means focus. We're supposed to have focus in everything we do, but we find a tremendous emphasis when it comes to prayer on kavanah. So much so that Maimonides says that when you daven and you pray, without kavanah, it's a useless prayer. Now that's quite harsh, but we pray even though we don't have kavanah. That's the truth, right? But nevertheless, essential to the concept of prayer is the concept of focus. And a lot of that focus comes from hitbonanut. Hitbonanut means to take, and sometimes it's not possible to do the entire prayer. Now, just before I tell you what it is, it's an interesting thing when it comes to prayer. The Zohar says, see, meditation is supposed to bring to inner peace. It's supposed to bring a sense of oneness, a sense of calmness, a sense of focus. The truth is, that's not always the imagery, or that's not always the association with prayer. And for good reason. The Zohar says that the time of prayer is a time of war. It's a time of struggle. And most people experience this. Most people do not report back that prayer is a very calming experience. Most people find prayer very struggling. It's a struggling thing. It's a difficult thing to do. And there's all sorts of reasons for it. The language is prescriptive. For some people it's monotonous. Some people don't actually understand what they're doing. They don't understand what the words mean. They struggle. It's a bit to pray in Hebrew, in English, all these kind of different things, right? So it is true that the prayer itself is a difficult process. But when one applies hitbonanut to prayer, when one applies proper focus to prayer, and not necessarily the whole prayer, and the words of prayer are holy, and they've got a formula, and even if we're not up to it, and we're not doing great meditation, it's always good to pray. Praying is never a bad thing. However, when we maximize the potential of prayer, and we do it with what we call hitbonanut, which is a sort of a meditative process, then it becomes actually a very calming thing, and it becomes a very focused thing, and it's a means to be able to create that focus, that intensity, and even inner peace and oneness and calmness, which meditation is supposed to achieve, which of course leads to the practice of mindfulness in a very, very deep way. Now, hitbonanut, just let me explain to you what it means. Hitbonanut means, in its association with prayer, it means, in fact, there's two types of hitbonanut. One type of hitbonanut is to take a concept connected with prayer and do this before prayer. There were many, many great people that before prayer, they would spend a lot of time in hitbonanut. They would take a concept to do with the prayer and focus on it in very, very deep thought before beginning to pray. But the hitbonanut that I want to share with you is hitbonanut during prayer. And what it means is taking a section, a phrase of the prayer and focusing on it. Shutting out distractions and having a deep focus and contemplation and reflection and understanding of what that phrase means. And you think about it again and again and again until you connect with it, until you internalize it. That's in essence, in a nutshell, what the hitbonanut to do with prayer actually means. And therefore, when we take a section of prayer and we do it properly, that becomes a great vehicle to this concept of meditation and this concept of hitbonanut. Now, before I share with you one, let me just bring this back to the whole concept of mindfulness. So let's go back to the very, very beginning of the mindfulness discussion. So mindfulness is learning to be fully present and focus on the now. It's the concept of the beginner's mind. In other words, what I'm doing now, I've got a completely fresh perspective. I've let go of the past, shut out the future, the part that I cannot control. I understand the freshness and the purity of every opportunity, of every moment, whether it's walking, whether it's eating, whether it's breathing. But you'll also remember that the very first week we talked about Jewish mindfulness being one that we don't only focus on the external, we focus on the internal. So in every moment, in any experience, we're not only focusing on what we call the guf, which is the body, we focus on the neshama, which is the soul, what's behind the moment. Every moment, the idea of mindfulness is to be aware of the opportunity of every moment. Jewish mindfulness is to be aware of the depth of every moment, the meaning and purpose of every moment, the soul behind every moment, right? So therefore, when we talk about mindfulness exercises or mindfulness meditation, although the breathing exercises are great and they have their place, the eating exercises, the raising exercises, whatever the meditation, it all will enhance the concept of mindfulness. But if we really want to maximize the mindfulness opportunity, and you want to reflect on mindfulness at a deeper level in terms of being aware not only of the moment but of the soul of the moment, then what we need to do is we need to engage in a deeper meditation exercise. And an example of that is this concept of itbananut. To take a meaningful concept, not just a taste of a food or a breathing externally, but to take a deeper phrase, a deeper concept, and apply the mindfulness exercise to it. Are we being clear? Are we? Yeah? Okay. So what I want to do is, I want to share with you one, and I want to share with you a famous phrase, and I'm going to choose a phrase which most of you will be familiar with, a phrase that we say every single day, many people say many, many times a day. It's a phrase that, in the Jewish tradition, we've lived and died by this phrase since time immemorial, and it's the sentence of the Shema Yisrael. Okay. Now, at a very, very simple level, this is the Shema, right? Shema Yisrael, let's just translate it. Shema Yisrael, listen Israel, this is Moses talking to the Jewish people. He says, listen Israel, God our God, God is one. On a very simple level, there's a mitzvah to recite the sentence every single day. It's a declaration of our faith. It's a declaration of our belief in the oneness of God, in the belief of the existence of God, and so on and so forth. However, it's not just a simple sentence. This sentence is a very, very deep sentence. Now, the reason I choose this sentence is because in halachic literature, focus during prayer is very important, but focus during this sentence is critical. There are three places, just as a point of interest, there are three sentences or three paragraphs in the entire prayer where the concept of kavanah is absolutely essential. And one of them is the Shema. Shema perhaps being the most important one. Okay. So, the Shema is a perfect sentence to apply the concept of hitbananut, this meditative practice, which teaches us to completely focus, to stop, to think of what the words mean, to focus on their meaning, to the exclusion of all other distractions, and use that to internalize and to bring a sense of oneness and peace, inner peace, and to use that as an exercise to practice achieving this concept of focusing and absorbing the moment to the exclusion of other distractions. And I'm going to go through with you. Now, what I'm going to go through with you is a lot. In other words, I'm going to break it down into four phrases. And each phrase has a tremendous depth behind it that we can actually think about and absorb and focus on when we're saying it. The way to do it is to actually have time. That's the way to do any mindfulness exercise, is to actually spend time on it and to not rush. In the Bonanut process, it means to actually say the words, to stop, and then to think about the content. To think about it again, not just to think about it. You see, meditation is not study. We need to understand that very, very clear distinction. To read something, when you read a book or you read a paragraph or you read an explanation on something, you read it quickly. If you've got a fast mind, you've understood it, and you go on to the next thing. Right? That is called studying something or learning something. That's not called meditating on something. Hitbananut means to think about it deeply, to think about it, reflect on it, think about it again and again until you feel you've absorbed it and you're connecting to it. That's a whole different process. Now, before I break down the different phrases of the Shema, why this is an excellent sentence to talk about the whole focus and the process of meditation and hitbananut is because there's a very interesting law connected with how you say the Shema. Number one, when we say the Shema, we're supposed to sit. That's the preferable way of saying the Shema. Right? The preferable way of saying the Shema is to be in a sitting position. So in order to focus, in order to relax. It's also the one part of prayer that we cover our eyes. And why do we cover our eyes? Many commentaries say the reason is to shut out distractions. To exclude, not to be distracted by anything from the outside. Okay. So therefore, the way to do it, therefore, is number one, to sit. Before we start, remember the meditation, the mindfulness meditation means you first of all got to set up, you've got to have the right setting. So we sit, we focus, we cover our eyes, and we remove distractions. We're not rushed, we're relaxed, and then we go through the sentence. And I want to show you the actual thought process. And again, what I'm going to share with you is only one interpretation and one way to do it. There are many, but this is one way, and it ties very much in on a deeper level, but it ties much into the whole mindfulness concept. So let's go through it. The first one is Shema Yisrael. Now, Shema Yisrael literally means just listen, Israel, but it's much deeper than that. First of all, the thing to think about when you say the word Shema Yisrael is, the word Shema means to listen. In other words, we get ourselves in a frame of mind that we're ready to listen. We're ready to absorb. We're ready to internalize, and we're ready to be aware. Now, when we say the Shema Yisrael, the reflection, the meditation, the thought process that goes in our mind is this. Shema, we're ready to listen. We're ready to absorb. We're open. I remember that's the freshness of the mind. We need to be open without taking baggage from the past or the future. We're ready to maximize the moment. Ready to be open. Ready to absorb what we're thinking about. And we refer to ourselves at that moment as Yisrael. Now, we are called the Bnei Yisrael, correct? But the truth is that we have two names. Our ancestor is Yaakov, not just Yaakov had two names, Yaakov and Yisrael. The reason he had two names is because it represents two types of people. The word Yaakov means a heel, Akev, a heel, that normally refers to a downtrodden type of person. The word Yisrael comes from the word Sar Kael, it's a name of prominence, it's a name of strength. Sar Kael, an officer of God. So when you say the Shema, the first thought to focus on is, Shema, I'm ready to absorb. I'm completely focusing. I'm shutting out anything else. I'm not being distracted. And I'm revealing the prominence. I'm revealing the inner strength that I have. And I'm ready to access that strength to maximize the full and infinite potential of the now. Okay? So that's the Shema Yisrael. That's the first phrase. Then we move on. Now, I'm just going to go back to show you something so that we understand this. If you look at the center Shema Yisrael in Hebrew, if you look at the name of God, I'm just going to... You see that they're red there? Technology for you, right? That's the way the name of God is written in the Chumash. Now, we don't pronounce it that way. All right? Important to understand. When we see the name of God, Yud and Hey and Vav and Hey, that's the way it's written, but it's not the way we pronounce it. That's considered the holiest name of God, and that's why we don't pronounce it that way. We pronounce it with the word Adon, right? Ador and Nai. I'm not going to say it all because we never say the name of God just out of context. So I'm going to refer to it as Hashem. But it's written Yud and Hey and Vav and Hey. It's pronounced Ador and Nai, right? I share that with you because when we focus on the Shema and we contemplate and reflect on its meaning with intense focus, the focus is connected with both names, the one that we say and the one the way it's written. Okay? So let's see how that works out. So the next word of the Shema is Hashem's name, God's name. We pronounce it Ador and Nai, and it's written Yud and Hey and Vav and Hey. Why is it so important? Because if I say Shema Yisrael, which means I'm now focusing, I'm ready to absorb, I'm ready to listen, I understand I'm fully present, because that's the idea of Shema, we're covering our eyes, we're shutting out the distractions, I'm fully here, ready to listen, ready to absorb, but where am I? That's the question. And this goes back to the heart of Jewish mindfulness. Where am I is I'm not just me. I'm before something more powerful than me. That's the greatness of the moment. The power of each moment, and this is the meditation of Shema, is that I'm before a much greater and infinite power than just the now that is superficial. The now that is superficial is a very limited now. The now that I'm really in and present in is an infinite now because it's before an infinite God. And the infinity of God is represented in the name of Yud and Hey and Vav and Hey. The name of God, the holiest name of God, which is the Yud and the Hey and the Vav and the Hey, contains in it three words, Hayah, Hoveh, and Yihyeh, was, is, and will be. It's the omnipotence and the omnipresence of God. Right? That's the power of where I am. And that's the power, that's the point I'm really trying to drive, that mindfulness from a Jewish concept, when we take it in a deeper level, the infinity of every moment is amazing. The opportunity and the freshness of every moment is incredible because it's not a superficial moment. It's a moment where we are surrendering to a much greater power. We are standing before the now is a now which is part of a much greater and more infinite power, the power of God, the divine energy. And therefore we pronounce it with the word Adon. Adon is master. Master means that this infinite power, it's my master. I'm surrendering to that master. Right? which means I'm becoming part of that infinite opportunity. And therefore, the way I put it down there is I'm aware that God is transcendent, omnipresent, omnipotent, and infinite. He is my Adon. I am ready to submit to His control, removing distraction from the very fragments of my existence. I feel His presence, right? That's what we think about. Allowing to fully connect with the potential and deeper meaning of every moment. I'm never alone, but in every experience and in every moment, He is part of me. If we can just absorb that for a few moments, mindfulness takes on a whole new dimension, right? Understand the infinite potential of every moment because we are never alone. And that gives the freshness of every moment, the beginner's mind of every moment, incredible infinity, incredible power. Before I go on, by the way, I have copies of this. You don't have to worry jotting it down. I have copies of this later. You're welcome to take it. Okay? So that's the next part of the word. So we have Shema Yisrael, I'm focusing, I'm ready to absorb, I have a sense of strength, and I'm before a greater power than me. I'm not alone, but the infinite God, I'm surrendering to His control. And then we go on, and the next phrase is we say Elokeinu, or Eloheinu, right? Now it's interesting that God has many names, but the one name of God that is conjugated in the Torah, the only one, is Elokim. So Elokeinu means He's our God. And that's taking it to a step further. What does that mean? What it means is He doesn't remain an abstract, removed existence, but I make Him my or our God, right? Our master. He's the God of strength, and that strength becomes mine. That's the meaning of Elokeinu. Becomes my strength. In other words, I'm connecting with Him. So the realization that we said when we said God's name before, Hashem, that I'm not alone, but there's a presence of an infinite God, I try to take that a step further, and I focus on the thought that He's my God, and He becomes my strength, and becomes one thing. And His strength, His infinity, becomes my infinity, and therefore gives me that focus. And then what we do is, we end the Shema with a very, very famous phrase. And the famous phrase is, Hashem Echad. Okay. And let me just explain this before we read it together. In fact, let me just take it back. Right? If you look at the word Echad, right? Echad has three letters. Aleph, Chet, and Dalet. We are taught that Aleph represents God, the one God. Because the phrase Hashem Echad is on a very simple level, is the declaration of the oneness of God as one God. But it's not just one God. You see, our lives as physical people, and this is the crux of what this is all about. Our lives as physical people, we live in a very fragmented world, and we live a very fragmented existence, right? Which is why mindfulness is so hard. Because everything in our lives seems to compete with each other. As we said in the first time, particularly nowadays, running from one thing to another, running from one priority to another, running from one pull to another, everyone's attention, everyone needs attention, everything needs attention. One job, one deadline to another. It's a very, very fragmented existence, and every part of who we are often is all mixed up. It's one big challenge, as I say. Everything's competing with each other, and there's no sense of calmness, no sense of oneness. However, when we absorb what we spoke about last week, and that is that we live a life of values. And by the way, sorry, and that fragmentation is hinted in the Chet and the Dalet. We are taught in the Talmud that there are seven heavens. So the seven, each letter in the Hebrew letter has a gematria, has a numerical value. So therefore the Chet, the numerical value of Chet is 8. Right? There are seven heavens and one earth. Dalet is 4. The letter Dalet is 4, and that represents the 4 directions of the world. North, east, west, and south. But it doesn't only mean the physical directions, it means the directions, symbolic directions. We're pulled in different directions. That's the life that we live, which becomes very, very difficult. So that's the Chet and the Dalet represent our fragmented existence. However, when we focus on what we learned last week, that we live a life of values, and we live a life where we try and give meaning and purpose to that life, suddenly we go beyond the surface, beyond the goof, and we discover the soul of life. What happens is there becomes a common thread in everything that we do. And we're able to bring a sense of oneness into the fragmented existence that we live. When we have a direction, and we have a goal, and we have meaning and purpose to life, and we have a spiritual focus to life, not taking away in any way from the physical life that we live, But it's a physical life which has a neshama, it's got a soul behind it. It's got meaning and purpose, it's got values, it's got direction, it's got a mission. Suddenly there becomes a underlying goal, underlying theme, pattern, that starts to run through everything that we do, that even though superficially it all seems different. One day I'm taking care of my children, the next day I'm taking care of my job, the next moment I'm running here, I'm running there, but it's all based on my values, so therefore really they all fit into one long pattern. And they're all connected with the Aleph, because they all have the divine energy and the meaning and purpose and the depth which is driving the different fragments, and they were able to bring a sense of oneness into that thing. So therefore, when we understand that Hashem Elokeinu, when we understand that we're before God, before an infinite God, we understand the infinite potential of every moment, we understand that we're not alone, but there's a deeper existence and there's a deeper meaning, a deeper purpose to everything, that gives us that ability to bring Echad, to take the fragments of our life, and using the oneness of God to bring that oneness into all the fragments, to bring that sense of oneness and peace and calmness in everything that we do. Right? And therefore, just to read it through, it's a long one. It says, I acknowledge, become aware of and connect with the oneness of God. Right? Think of the different components and fragments of creation. The Chet, the heavens and the earth. The Dalet is what is in front, in the back, to the right and to the left. And then bring it back to the Aleph. No matter what it is, it can all be meaningful, deep, full of potential, and connect to His oneness. No moment or experience, smoothie or bumpy, easy or difficult, is more or less important than the other. That's what we did last week. Bringing the Chet and the Dalet to the Aleph brings inner tranquility, calmness, and a sense of unity and peace, bringing all the fragments of our life back into focus by discovering the infinite divineness in every moment. Clear? That's the meditation of Shema. Well, the purpose of all that is, now this takes a lot of practice. It's easy to read on paper. But to actually say the Shema the way is very, very difficult. So, what I recommend to you is take this, read it through and use it as an exercise. Don't do it all at once. It'll take time. If you say the Shema like this once a week at first, or twice a week, whatever the case is. But it takes time. It takes time to actually say the words and then to stop. But it takes What it always takes to do a mindfulness exercise. It takes shutting out distraction. It takes covering our eyes. It takes not rushing. It takes designated time. And to think through these concepts, not just to read them through and understand them, but to think them through, to absorb them, starting with the very first sentence of phrase of Shema Yisrael, being ready to absorb, being ready to focus, understanding that in every moment there's the external of the moment, the superficiality of the moment, but then there's the depth of the moment. We're not alone. We're together with the infinity of the divine energy, and all of that helps us then bring the focus into the fragments of the way we live. And that's one example of the concept of hitbonanut. There are other exercises that we can use which are more simpler, just to learn to be more mindful, the breathing exercises, the eating exercises, and so on and so forth. But if you want to give mindfulness a deeper level, if you want to give it depth, then this is a great way to do it. There are other concepts, there are other parts of prayer we can do it as well. But this is certainly a good way to start. Take the Shema and to actually do this again and again and again. To learn to focus. First of all, teaches us how to focus. And it's very difficult. You know, we think it's easy to focus for 30 seconds. It's not. When we start doing a mindfulness exercise, we realize how difficult it actually is. If we test ourselves, we say, I'm going to try and focus for the next minute. Then we realize during that minute, we've thought of 17 different things. Right? It's a very difficult exercise. It takes a lot of practice. But it takes a commitment to actually sit down. That's why closing eyes is a good idea, and to shut out all distractions, not to look at anything, not to think of anything, and to try and focus on the moment. And doing that by taking this content and focusing on each phrase and trying to absorb these concepts as we say the Shema. Through that we learn to focus, and through that the purpose is not to remain by the Shema. The purpose then is to bring that concept of focus into the whole day. Like any mindfulness exercise, the purpose is not the exercise. The purpose is to become mindful in everything that we do, to bring that sense of focus and awareness and mindfulness into every moment throughout the day as much as we possibly can. It doesn't happen the whole day, but it happens more and more as we keep practicing it. Now, what I want to do to conclude is use the next 15 minutes just to go through something that is in the writings of Dr. Kabat-Zinn, and he calls it the 9 attitudinal foundations of mindfulness practice. Okay? What this means is, we can go through just 9 attitudes that help to cultivate. A lot of them are interrelated and they overlap with each other, and we've talked about some of them, but it's a great list. We can't work on all these attitudes together at once, but these are attitudes to have in mind, to have a list, and to revisit them once in a while, each one. Each of these attitudes, when we develop them as mindsets and as attitudes, they become helpful in developing the whole concept of becoming mindful and being aware in the now and being aware of the present. And I'm going to run through them with you and end with that. So the first one is non-judging. Now, we talked about non-judging last week, but here it's a different non-judging. Not just not to judge our own thoughts, but not to judge the experience, right? You know, often it's very, very hard to be mindful because, again, mindful is not just about being aware of the present, right? Mindful is about being aware of the present with a freshness, with a beginner's mind. So often we go into a situation and before we know it, before we even experience the experience, we've already judged it and we've colored our whole experience and we've messed it up, right? For example, we go into a meeting. You go into a meeting, but you kind of judge the meeting before you start. I know the guys, I know what they like, I know what they're going to say, I know they're going to waste time. I know this guy is a difficult, stubborn guy, so we've already gone into the meeting, right? That's impossible to be mindful in that meeting. And it's very difficult not to do that because we do judge as human beings because we know people and we have past experiences. It's difficult not to do that. But when you go into a meeting, for example, non-judgmentally, there's a much greater opportunity to experience that meaning in a greater way. Now, it might turn out the way you would have judged it, but nevertheless, there's a much greater chance if you take away all the pre-judging of what you think is going to happen, the experience becomes a much greater opportunity. Or we meet someone. Have you ever met someone, like with the first few moments, you form an opinion of what kind of guy this is? Oh, I see already. This guy's like, you know, maybe he's not like that. Maybe he's a bit nervous for the first few minutes. Maybe actually he's a completely different personality. And if we let ourselves not judge, we might discover a completely different person, right? Or you hear a speaker. You know, sometimes you switch off in the first 3 seconds. Speakers have a tough, they got the first 3 minutes like the crucial time because otherwise they could have lost, you know, you lose them for the whole hour. Maybe he warms up. Maybe this 10 minutes later he's really good, but you know, we judged it right at the beginning, right? So all that kind of stuff. So therefore, sometimes if we become aware of these judgments and we learn to manage them better, we try to develop an attitude of being non-judgmental in general, that clears the way, it clears the air to experience every moment in a much greater way. Which of course then leads to the next concept of the beginner's mind. Which the beginner's mind we talked about right in the beginning, but beginner's mind is not just what mindfulness is, it's also an attitude. As we quoted the beginner's mind, there's many possibilities and experts, there are few, but it's also developing an attitude of being in beginner's mind. It's an attitude of going into an experience as a beginner, trying to leave everything behind and I'm completely have a fresh attitude, trying completely in a fresh way to experience the moment to its fullest. The third one is patience. This is a hard one, of course. This is a great quote. We are always trying to get someplace else. We have a strong need to be on the way to a better moment, some better time when it will come together for me. We're just never sure when that... We're always waiting for that moment and no one ever knows when that moment is arriving, right? So patience is just a general critical concept to develop and to work on if one wants to enhance the process of mindfulness. Without patience, mindfulness doesn't work. Because patience is the very ingredient that makes us rush from one thing to another because we're always trying to get over what we're doing in order to get to the next thing, and therefore it's impossible to be mindful. Mindfulness at any level requires that concept of patience. The next one is trust. Now, trust is an interesting one because trust refers to trusting others, but also means trusting ourselves. Now, trusting ourselves is a difficult process. I've talked about this in other contexts, that some people often say, you know, I trust my instincts, and that's actually very dangerous sometimes because our instincts are not always right. Our instincts are not always right because the human being is a complex machine. We have good parts of our personality, we have animalistic parts of our personality. And when you have an instinct to do something or a desire to do something or just feels right, as people say, that feels right might not come from the right place. We have a struggle within us. We have two parts of our personality. We have what's called a godly soul and an animal soul. And our instinct or our desire doesn't always come from the godly soul. Sometimes it comes from the animal soul. So therefore, we don't always trust ourselves. Reflection is a very good thing. Research, exploring, rethinking is all very, very important. But at the end of the day, however, we also have to have some level of trust. When we've gone through the process and we've made a decision, we have to trust ourselves. And trusting ourselves is connected to mindfulness because sometimes when you're in an experience and you self-doubt, it makes it impossible to experience that moment to the fullest. And therefore, when we've done our due diligence on a value-based level, and we tried our best, we also have to develop a bit of trust for our own decisions so that we can fully experience what we're trying to experience. Next one is a very, very critical one. It's what he calls non-striving. Let's just stop here for a moment, because non-striving is an interesting one. You know, in Judaism, ambition plays a very important role, provided it's kept in check. Right? Why is ambition important? Because ambition is the ingredient of growth. As human beings, we need to grow, and therefore we do need to ambition. We do need to have ambition. We do need always to strive to become higher, to become better. Right? The danger of ambition, however, is that we're never happy with where we are. So we're always striving to do something better, and therefore we're never able to experience where we are. And the question is, how does it come together? And it comes together with the concept we talked about last week. We need to reflect on what type of life are we living. Are we living a value-based living or an outcome-based living? In other words, is our success in what we achieve? Is our success the destination or is our success the journey? Right? As we said last week, that in Jewish thought, the journey is as important, if not more important sometimes, than the destination. So on the one hand, of course we have to grow. And we have to always try and do better. But it's not doing better to reach a goal, to reach a destination. It's about doing better tomorrow than I am today. And therefore it's about doing better in the journey. So the ambition is important. But we have to be careful that we develop an attitude of non-striving. Non-striving means not always striving to do different or be different than we are now. Because where we are now, provided it's in a context of continuous growth, continuous reflection, continuous effort to become better, where we are now is fantastic. We need to celebrate that success as well, even though it's not a destination, even though it's only part of the journey. Because the journey is really, really important. As we said last week, everything we do is part of divine service. It's important. It might be a means to an end, but there's no such thing as a means to an end. Because if it's important, it's important if we learn to live it now and to be fully absorbed. The sixth one is the concept of acceptance. And acceptance has two components. The first is giving up control. See, very, very often we're not able to experience a moment properly, we're not able to be present in the now, because we have expectations for the now to be different. And we have expectations for the now to be different because we erroneously think that we can control what happens to us. Acceptance means to accept that God runs the world, and to give up the control. To give up the control, and therefore what is supposed to happen, happens. Unless it's a moral judgment. As I said last week, everything is in the hands of heaven besides fear of heaven. In other words, our moral decisions are our control, but everything else is in God's control. So therefore, the quicker we accept that, that's the concept of acceptance, and we give up that control, the quicker we're able to experience the moment properly, because it's the moment which is supposed to be. The moment that I'm living now, what is happening now is what is supposed to happen now. If I understand that, I'm able to absorb it, I'm able to be present. If I constantly think that what is happening to me now, the experience I'm experiencing now, really should be something different, it becomes impossible to experience the now properly. And therefore acceptance is a very, very important concept. The other aspect of acceptance also is lowering expectations. You know, very, very often this is particularly true in relationships. Very, very often, you know, mindfulness plays a very big role in relationships. Very often in relationships, we don't experience and enjoy and absorb the relationship to its fullest. And part of the reason often is because we keep hoping that the other guy is going to change. Right? And generally speaking, we can change ourselves, but other people we shouldn't expect to change, right? And we have expectations. And as long as those expectations are not met, it bothers us. And it bothers us, it stands in the way of us fully experiencing the relationship. We're always hoping for something different. We're always hoping for a different response, for the person to do something different. Now, a person has needs, and we can certainly communicate that, and we can discuss that. But when we lower our expectations, and we learn to accept people for who they are, not judgmentally, that's a very important part of acceptance. It helps experience the richness and the depth of the relationship the way we are now, and it brings mindfulness into relationships. And therefore, that's another incredible, important attitude when it comes to mindfulness. The seventh one is letting go. Letting go is a hard one. And it includes all kinds of letting go. Because that's the key problem when it comes to mindfulness, that we're not able to experience it now because we have baggage. And letting go means to forgive. Letting go means not to blame. As long as we hang on to all sorts of things that happened in the past, we're never able to experience the now. So if we don't let go of other people's hurt, letting go means to forgive. It doesn't mean to agree that it's right, but it means to let go of the resentment. As long as we keep blaming other people for the way we are, then we're unhappy the way we are now. We're not able to experience where we are now. The more we can let go, and letting go is a very difficult thing. It's not as quick as we're saying it now. Right? Letting go is a very difficult process, but the more we can learn to develop the attitude of letting go, the more mindful we can become. The eighth one is gratitude. Gratitude is a very, very important one. You know, gratitude... No, it's not a sports team, the Roosters. Gratitude is an important mindset to develop generally for all sorts of things. It brings happiness, it brings fulfillment, but also is very much connected with mindfulness. And I put that list up there because if you look in a prayer book, right, if you look at the Siddur, we'll notice at the very, very beginning of the Siddur, after the Modei Ani, which we did the first week, there's a long list of what we call morning blessings. And they're an amazing thing. Why? You know what we thank God for? We thank God for all the things that we never even think about. Right? We thank God for the rooster who tells the difference between day and night. Okay, we don't get up with roosters anymore, but the concept, right? We're able to get up in the morning, tell the difference between day and night. We thank God for opening up our eyes. How many of us actually stop every morning and say, wow, you know, the fact that I opened my eyes today, I'm not taking that for granted. The fact that we can get up and stretch, the fact that we can actually walk around, the fact that we have clothing, the fact that we have strength, the fact that we have shoes, all these things are included in the morning blessings. Now, part of the purpose of those blessings are gratitude, because starting the day with gratitude is incredibly important, and modern literature will tell us that starting the day with gratitude is incredibly beneficial, physically and emotionally and psychologically. However, it brings another concept. When we have gratitude and we develop a mindset of gratitude, it automatically increases our mindfulness, because if we stop taking things for granted, we become aware of the things that we have to be thankful for. When you become aware of the things we have to be thankful for, we do them differently. If we become aware that we actually have to be thankful for the ability to get out of bed and to walk to the next room, we become aware of the walking. We become aware that we're doing that. And we become aware of the gift that we received. We become aware of the clothing when we get dressed. We become aware that that's the whole concept of making blessings before we eat. Same idea. The bracha, the blessings before we eat, is also a form of gratitude. And when you make a blessing before you eat, you become aware of the gift that we have food. And then you become aware of why we're eating, and the whole concept of eating mindfully takes on a whole new depth. So gratitude is directly linked, therefore, to the concept of mindfulness. And the last one is an interesting one. It's the concept of kindness. Kindness, what does kindness do? When we develop an attitude of kindness, kindness is a good thing always, but kindness allows a person to go beyond themselves. When a person prevents themselves from being kind, they become locked, they become trapped. When we're kind, it allows us to go beyond who we are, because we go beyond ourselves, out of our comfort zone, to give to the other. Why that's connected to mindfulness is because mindfulness is about experiencing a moment, being present and aware of the moment, in a way where we maximize the potential of the moment, and in a way where we're not stuck within ourselves. We're not stuck in the past. We're not stuck in our preconceptions. We're not stuck in our judgments. All the things we've been talking about till now. Mindfulness requires a sense of being free, of being able to say, I'm letting go, and I'm able to go beyond myself to maximize the infinite potential, particularly on a deeper level, the infinite divine potential that exists in every single moment. In order to do that, kindness helps that happen, because kindness trains us to go beyond ourselves, not to be stuck in who we are, and therefore it also enhances the concept of mindfulness. That is just very, very briefly these nine attitudes. And I thought it would just be a good way to end off, because these are the nine attitudes which we can revisit and relook at all the time to check ourselves, are we sort of developing them and giving ourselves the ability to become more mindful. So that's the mindfulness concept in a nutshell. Now, just to end off, of course, reminding ourselves, that mindfulness is not a 3-week series. Mindfulness is a lifelong work in progress. It's an amazing concept. It definitely allows us to live differently. It's now used in the States, as I said at the beginning, it's now used all over the world, in fact, to reduce stress, to treat depression, all these things, because when we are fully present in the moment and we're actually able to live each moment properly, particularly in the context of developing and revealing the deeper level, a deeper layer of life from a Jewish perspective, the whole concept of Jewish mindfulness, it definitely has all these side benefits of bringing inner peace and happiness and fulfillment. So I just wanted to thank everyone for coming, and and being a great audience. If I can just ask you, right from the beginning, there's a box here. So if you don't mind filling out, you can do it anonymously if you want to. Just fold it up and put it. It'll help us for future planning. And thank you very much and have a great week.